Hi there, House Culture listener. If you enjoy this episode or have enjoyed listening to other episodes in our series, please support and donate to us through the Acast supporter feature. All donations will help us create the content that you love listening to. You can decide how much you give and there's no regular commitment. So it could be a one-off and every now and then or once every time you listen. It's up to you. Click on the supporter link that you can find in the episode or show description, and with Google or Apple Pay, it will take you less than 30 seconds to make your payment.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hi, this is Dave Seaman, and you're listening to the House Culture Podcast.
House Culture.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode in our fourth season of the House Culture Podcast, hosted as ever by me, the managing editor at House Culture, Matt Rouse. As I said on the season opening episode last time around, I'm thrilled to be back behind this mic talking to you guys, and I'd like to say hi to everyone tuning back in and to those newbies who might not have listened before. If you fall into that latter category, we are House Culture, a collective of house music fans who have come together through their mutual love of the beat to celebrate the spirit of house music. Come follow us on our Instagram feed at HouseCultureNet. You can hook up with over 100,000 other beat lovers from across the planet. And don't forget to have a flick through our back catalogue of episodes, as we always make sure our guests are interesting and have a fascinating story to tell. Whether it's hearing from legends like David Morales talking about making iconic anthems, behind the scenes scenesters like Pikes Hotel creative director Dawn Hindle discuss the goings on at an Ibizan institution, or you want to hear from leaders of the new school like Josh Butler, Andrea Oliva, or the Picard brothers, we have got you covered. Now, let's get on with this next episode. In this one, I spoke to a former editor of Mixmag, a brother in rhythm, a label boss of arguably some of the greatest imprints from within our scene, someone who is synonymous with huge clubbing brands like Renaissance and Global Underground. It can only be the one and only Dave Seaman. In our chat, you'll hear how he was in exactly the right place at the right time.
Well, house music arrived and that turned everything on its head. And I was very, very lucky to get a job at Mixmag in 1987. And 1987 was the year that DJ culture really started to become a thing.
The kind of era that he oversaw as editor of an industry bible.
The real glory years of Acid House. I was editor through the Second Summer of Love. It was the most magical of times.
How, after over three decades in the game, technology has helped him grow as a DJ and artist.
As technology developed, rather than it being like one record into the next one, you could start having layer upon layer, and it could become like this really quite creative audio collage, a real piece of art. The idea of mixing became something way, way, way more than just going from one record to the next.
And why music will always play a huge part in his life.
Music is the healing force, isn't it? It's the language that we all speak, no matter where we come from, and can bring everybody together and do so much. So yeah, we'll always be there. One of the main things that in my life, for sure.
I hope you enjoy this one. This is Dave Seaman.
House Culture.
Hi Dave, it's a pleasure to have you on the House Culture podcast today. Thanks so much for sitting down with us. You're a titan of dance music, someone who has been the editor of an industry bible, a DJ that has played for all the major clubbing institutions around the world, a producer and remixer that has worked with genuine top-tier talent such as Kylie Minogue and the Pet Shop Boys, and a label head that's presided over the release of some genuine anthems of our scene. When you put it all together like that, how does that make you feel?
Yeah, well, it's been 30 years, so I've got to put a few things in there, haven't I?
That's cool. Before we come on to delving deep into all of that, we always like to go back and start at the beginning with all of our guests. Can you tell us about growing up in Leeds and how you first got into music there when you were young?
I started just collecting records, really. I wasn't playing an instrument as such, but I loved music. So I just was listening to the radio a lot. Mm-hmm. But remember, radio back then wasn't even FM. It was, you know, it was medium wave. So when you listen to the radio, it was pretty, you know, it was in mono, it's bad quality. Yeah. You know, you got a good reception without it hissing and crackling and all that kind of thing. So when you got a record and you put it on a turntable at home, your home stereo system, and you listen to this piece of music in stereo, it was like another world. Mm-hmm. So that experience, I think, was really exciting. So yeah, I just started collecting records from about 7 or 8, probably. Mm-hmm. You know, picking up bits from various members of the family, and it was just, yeah, got a bit obsessed with it. Sort of spent all my pocket money on records, and then that sort of naturally became a thing about DJing then, really, because obviously, mm-hmm, people that had lots of records played them to people. Yeah. And you know, birthday parties or weddings, or when we were away on holiday, that's when I you know, saw these people playing these records to people and everybody having a fantastic time, which was addictive.
Yeah.
I wanted to do that. So this is from a very, very early age, 8, 9 or something, way before DJing was anything like it is now. You know, the biggest thing you could hope for back then was a gig in the local nightclub on a Friday night, and that was about it. You know, the thought of traveling around the world doing it to thousands of people, yeah, all looking at you, by the way, that was a big change for DJing. You know, when everybody turned to face the DJ in the late 80s, as opposed to, you know, at these weddings and stuff, people, you know, you were just the person in the corner,
yeah,
providing the service of playing the music. You weren't the focus, really. So yeah, so that's how I kind of got into it. It was the local youth club at school, actually, school disco. I used to, you know, go and watch the guy who was doing it every Tuesday at the junior youth club, junior school disco.
Yeah.
And one week he was ill, and the guy who ran the youth club said, well, you've got some records, why don't you do it for a bit? You know what you're doing, you've been watching him for the last few weeks. So I kind of, yeah, okay. And that was it. I was only 12, I think, 13.
Wow. And you got the bug just then. I mean, it's, yeah, to be collecting records at that kind of young age as well, it shows, and you say at that point, there wasn't like a pursuit of fame or anything like that. It was just a case of you love this and you want to bring it to share this passion with more and more people. I mean, at that time, was there any, before that first kind of gig, even at that youth club, I suppose, were you collecting any particular type of genre? When you look back, did you have a particular avenue that were you focusing down, or was it just everything?
No. Pop music, yeah. Mm-hmm. Pop music. Music that was in the charts. This, you know, again, we're talking about late 70s, early 80s, around that time now. And yes, of course, there were genres going on. There was lots of things. 1979, 80, around that time, early 80s, was crazy for all the different tribes, all different things going on. Post-punk, new romanticism, you know, there's loads of stuff. But I was only picking up the stuff that was going into the charts, and it was, you know, the best of all the genres were going, it was going into the charts. Yeah, the charts was very, very varied in its style. So yeah, I was picking the best of the best of each genre, really, the ones that was making the pop charts.
Yeah. And do you remember that first gig, that big break, even before you were a teenager, how it went down, what it felt like, what you were playing, with the reactions?
Well, yeah, I mean, back then, you know, when you were doing, it was a very good apprenticeship to play to people's weddings or at the youth club or whatever, because as I just alluded to then, there's lots of tribes around that time. It's not so much the case anymore. I don't really see teenagers today. They kind of, you know, like a bit of everything, but they don't have to put themselves into one camp. You know, back then I had to play a little bit of goth. I had to play a little bit of heavy metal. I had to play a little bit of the Jam. I had to play a little bit of David Bowie. I had to play a little bit of, you know, go on and on. There was a bit of rock and roll. You're talking weddings, a bit of rock and roll for the, you know, older people, Northern Soul, you know, and I had to have a little bit of everything, of all those different kind of genres, and you had to cater to everybody. Everybody, I remember the youth club was, you know, it was a case of everybody, you know, was waited for their little moment when you was going to play a couple of Jam records, and all the Jam fans came on, and then play a couple of heavy metal records, and then all they came on, and then they all went back off to the side again. So yeah, it was quite eclectic. Yeah. It was a good way to try to keep as many people happy as possible, which is a good motto to you know, to still have in the in the back of your mind these days. And it was a good way to keep abreast of all different kinds of music, you know, all the best of all genres, as I said before. Ones that tended to make the pop charts, the ones that were the most popular in each genre, was a good place to you know, to start your education on each genre, each style of music.
Yeah, a real fertile ground. I was going to use the word education. Yeah, it's just to be able to pick up all of those genres and you know, and know what works within each one of those ones. It's a, you know, it's a real feather in your cap. I mean, so you're at the youth club and you played on these decks. I mean, you had a record player at home, obviously. What was the step up in terms of buying some more equipment or anything like that? You know, was it a case of, okay, you've seen the equipment that this guy in the youth club's got, I need to have that? Or how did those first set of decks come about?
Well, yeah, I mean, again, we're talking about one of these mobile, you know, the double deck units, foul double decks that I had to go and do various, because I kind of escalated quite quickly for me in my local area, and I ended up doing lots of people's birthday parties and lots of restaurants, and I was doing, you know, by the time I was 15-16, I was doing lots of pubs in my local village, two or three nights a week, and So I had to have mobile equipment. I didn't have a pair of Technics, so it was too advanced for the time. And this is pre-house music, really. You know, we're talking 87 was when I moved down to London and started working for Mixmag, which I'm sure we'll get onto in a minute. That's when really dance music, house music exploded, and the art of mixing. I was aware of the art of mixing. I used to devour Record Mirror, was the magazine at the time that used to have a DJ column in it, that written by James Hamilton. So I used to devour that every week, and you know, used to, you know, be aware of club music and DJs in clubs and stuff. But that wasn't what I was doing. I was trying to, as I say, cater for, you know, everybody from Smiths fans to you know, to the goths who wanted a bit of Cure or whatever, Sisters of Mercy or whatever. So it was just a mobile rig that I got. I think I would have been 14, I think, Christmas. I got my parents bought me a set of double decks, foul double decks. And I had all the mobile lighting and you know, rope light and a little scoop, all that kind of thing. And used to take that round with me. So these were belt driven. These weren't even you know, direct drive like Technics are, so you couldn't really mix on them. But, I tried my best. It was a good. and if you can really, you know, get even the tiniest bit of a hang on it on belt driven turntables, then it stands you in good stead for when you're onto the proper stuff. Like learning to drive in a clapped out, you know, clapped out Fiesta, and then getting into a Rolls Royce.
And at that stage, you were teaching all of this yourself. There weren't any like mentors or anything like that. You were just kind of going by your own groove and vibe and just checking out what's happening on the dance floor.
Again, I mean, it's hard to really kind of put into words, you know, the difference of that era, that time, to what we have now. I mean, I didn't have access to any kind of dance music, really. There was no radio, no dance music on the radio. I didn't have any radio shows. There's no internet. You know, my thirst for wanting to learn about DJing was limited to two pages in a magazine once a week, you know, which I probably read four or five times every week again and again, because that's all the access I had. Or maybe, you know, the senior youth club, on a Friday night, which eventually I gravitated to, but they had another DJ came in and did that, who was a professional mobile DJ. Mm-hmm. And so I used to see him and watch him. I wasn't old enough to go to clubs. Yeah. I had no access, no Top of the Pops on a Thursday night on, you know, was the pop music program on the TV every week that mm-hmm. everybody used to watch. And I had Radio One, which just played, you know, music from the charts. That was it. So I didn't have any access to any mentors. No YouTube videos that I could watch forever and ever. I mean, now, you know, you literally could, you know, find YouTube videos about the most niche thing and probably find enough videos to keep you going for a week.
Yeah, yeah. go down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, but none of that. So you're kind of making it up as you go along, really. I mean, I used to hang out in record shops. That was another good mm-hmm. place to gather experience and knowledge. And used to, you know, do a lot of vinyl collecting and just try and learning stuff from other people that were into music at the time.
Cool. And so what would you say was your kind of big break, or almost the point where maybe did you think, oh, I could do this as a career, or, you know, this is what I want to do with my life, or what kind of happened there?
Well, house music arrived, didn't it? And that kind of turned everything on its head. And I was very, very lucky to get a job at Mixmag in 1987. The first house music kind of arrived into the UK via things like Marshall Jefferson's Move Your Body, Jack Your Body, Steve Silkerley, mm-hmm. some of these Chicago records arriving from Chicago that went into the charts, went to number one. Jack Your Body went in at number one, you know, so it came with a bit of a with impact. It was like, wow, what is this music? And 1987 was the year that that DJ culture really started to become a thing. The advent of technology, of samplers, became available, and so DJs that worked in clubs that had the ideas that of what kind of music worked on a dance floor, but had never previously had the equipment or the studios or the ability really to make their own music. Mm-hmm. If they weren't classic, you know, if they weren't a trained musician, and, you know, it was very expensive to go in studios back then. So you're able to suddenly do this at home, you know, like on a basic computer and a sampler, or in a very basic, you know, keyboard and a very basic studio. It democratized music to a certain extent. And all of 1987, you had Cold Cut, Mars, S Express, Bomb the Bass, mm-hmm. all making sample records. These were records that, again, felt like they came from outer space. You know, like this was something was afoot, you know. Mm-hmm. There was a definite change. The DJ wasn't just, as I said, this guy in the background in the corner there who was just supplying a service. He became a focal point for the night, you know, almost like you would go and watch a band at a concert, you know. It was mm-hmm. that kind of turning point. And I was very lucky to get myself a job at Mixmag, which at the time was Mixmag was owned by DMC, who were the people that did the mixing and scratching championships, DJ championships. They also owned Mixmag. They also had studios and were doing exclusive remixes mm-hmm. for DJs only, not for sale. It was a subscription only service. You had to pay your subscription every month, and they sent you these exclusive remixes that nobody else could get, along with a copy of the magazine. Mm-hmm. It was a very industry based thing, and they were the only people doing it. This again was remixes weren't even really a thing back until around this time. They were really drove the whole idea of making different versions to play in nightclubs that that people haven't heard on the radio. Mm-hmm. Something new, something different. Extending, you know, various sections to make it better for in a nightclub environment.
Yeah.
So I was a member. Again, this was another thing, that a way of me trying to learn stuff about DJing. Uh-huh. I joined up with the DJ organization that sent me a magazine every month and some exclusive records. And I went to the 1987 convention mm-hmm. in London. Mm-hmm. It was where they gave the DMC awards away and did the mixing and scratching championships. And there was a raffle, a grand raffle, sponsored by Camel cigarettes. If you took a cigarette off the promo girl, you could fill your name and address in the hat, and, you know, you went into the grand raffle. And I came out of the hat first and won a week in New York at the New Music Seminar, which at the New Music Seminar at the time was sort of the equivalent of what the Miami Music Week is now, the Winter Music Conference, you know, it's an industry gathering, or the ADE in Amsterdam, you know, is an industry gathering. It was the only one of its kind, really, where people from the industry all went and gathered in New York for a week and you know, got ideas and did business deals and went clubbing and just generally hung out and partied.
And how old were you when you won that?
I was 19.
Wow.
So I wasn't even old enough to get into clubs in America at the time. But I went, I thought it was a hoax. I really did. I thought somebody was winding me up. But I did. I won the week in New York. I went out to New York for the week. I got to hang out with a lot of people from the UK record industry, you know, big people in dance music at the time, the people from DMC, you know, some of the big DJs from the radio were there. And you know, I was a kid in a sweet shop. I mean, I'd become obsessed with, as I said, trying to gather information about DJing and nightclubs through my teenage years. And all of a sudden I was in the epicenter. New York at the time, through the 80s, was the best place in the world for nightclubs and nightclubbing. I was in right in the eye of the storm all of a sudden. So
what clubbing experiences did you have out there? Like you said, you were too young to get into any clubs. Did you manage to get in and see anything? Or
Because I was very young looking anyway, but because I had an industry pass and I was with some other, you know, big people from the industry, I got into a few places. I went to Mars, I remember, was one particular one, which we really enjoyed, with Mark Kamins. And then, I went to a few other places. But the way I got my job at Mixmag was I'd been in New York all week with everybody. On my final day, I went out shopping, went out record shopping, went out clothes shopping, you know, just again, just trying to take in everything I possibly could of being in New York for my final few hours. And then on the final day, I went, after being running around New York for the day, we were staying at on Times Square at the Marriott Marquis, which is where the convention was being held. And I stopped at McDonald's just opposite on Times Square to get some food. I was starving. As I went back to the hotel, everybody, you know, from the group that we had kind of, you know, was hanging out with all week from DMC, were all in reception. They were all sort of about to go out for dinner, and they said, "Oh, do you want to come with us and for some food?" And I was like, "Oh, I've just eaten. I've just had my McDonald's. What are your plans for later? Are you going to do anything later?" And they said, "Oh yeah, we're going to go to Nell's, you know, if you want to come." And I said, "Oh, okay, all right, fine. I'll see you there." And walked off. And I found out later they all kind of went, "All right, okay, yeah, all right, you know, he was just walking off thinking he's going to get into Nell's, he's 19 and I didn't realize at all, but Nell's at the time was one of the hardest, most exclusive clubs to get into in New York. But I just met the guy who worked on the door at Nell's in the queue at McDonald's. He'd seen my pass and said, "Oh, you're here for the convention, you know, where are you from, blah blah blah." I got chatting. He said, "Oh, you should come to my club. Come to Nell's. Here's my card." I thought nothing of it. I put it in my car, in my pocket. Thought, "Oh, well, I'm never not going to do that." And then, of course, when they said it, I said, "Oh, I'll see you there."
Amazing.
I went to Nell's that night. I got in and went had a few drinks. And a couple of hours later, I was with somebody else that had won the competition as well. And a couple of hours after we'd been there, you know, it was the last night. It was getting late. I knew we had to fly back the next day, and there was no sign of anybody. I thought, "Oh, they're not gonna come." So I left the club, and there they all were on the pavement outside the club. They couldn't get in. So at that point, I'd had a few drinks, and I was like, "Oh no, come! Here's my friend Michael on the door. These are all my friends from England. Can come with you." He's like, "Yeah, come in." So I got all these people into the club that they couldn't get into, and I was the oik from Leeds, 19-year-old oik from Leeds. But yeah, about two weeks after I got back, the people who own DMC, Tony and Christine, rang me up and said, "You know, I don't know what we want you to do, but we obviously, if you can get us into a club in New York, then we think you could, you know, you could fit in here at DMC. You're the kind of person that we want here." I jacked in my job at an advertising agency in Leeds and went down to London to be T-boy. And that was 1987. It was just as the whole thing kicked off. So that was
incredible.
Undoubtedly a massive break. What a twist of fate. Right into the eye of the storm, the deep end. And
that's nuts.
That's where it all started.
from the queue of McDonald's to one of the elite clubs of New York to then
always talk to people in the queue at McDonald's. You don't know what you're going to get you.
When you're at a convention, just where you work, pass around, and people notice and it starts a conversation. That's incredible. And so the guys over at DMC were like, you know, we've got to have this guy on our team. Then obviously, you know, if you can do that, there's something special about him. And so, what was Mixmag like at that time? And I know you worked your way up to, and you became editor, and you were there for 3 years. I mean, like as editor for 3 years. I mean, what during that period, how did the music change and the actual publication change as well? What kind of era did you see in during your time there?
Well, again, like I said, we was right in the eye of the storm. It was the real glory years of Acid House. So I was editor through the second Summer of Love, you know, the 1988, 89, when raves around, you know, took off around the London Orbital, and you know, it was the most magical of times.
Yeah,
it was a brand new youth culture that was exploding, and I was right there, you know, right in the thick of it, living it. I started at DMC and as T-boy really, and then did a few reviews for the magazine, just was helping out in the studios, doing a bit of all sorts really. And then the editor left the magazine, and the magazine was, as I say, it was a subscription only. It was a DJ industry only thing. You had to be, you had to work in the industry to be able to get it. It wasn't on the magazine shelves. But as this whole culture was exploding, you know, things were really taking off fast. And the idea of the DJ and house music and electronic music and dance music and nightclubs and things were things were going into the charts becoming slowly but surely coming into mainstream culture.
Yeah.
So I saw that the magazine had the potential to become a magazine for the public, not just an industry magazine. And that was the direction that we took it in. We launched it to the public in July 1989. Mm-hmm. And then I was there for another couple of years after that. 88, 89, 90, 90, 91. I mean, wow.
That's the birth of it. I mean,
so we were making the rules up as we went along. The UK is brilliant. It was brilliant at youth culture, you know, exporting youth culture, you know, these tribes that we talked about earlier, you know, punk and new romanticism and mods and rockers before it and glam rock and all sorts of stuff that then was exported around the rest of the world. Well Acid House, you know, was another Acid House rave. Mm-hmm. So sometimes I say Acid House and people today think, oh, you mean that music that's got acid in it? Well, yes, that was part of it, but Acid House was a, you know, a whole culture, a whole movement. Yeah. It wasn't just a genre of music. It was a and that whole thing exploded. And I suppose a lot of us at the time thought, well, there's a few years in this, like there was for punk, like there was for new romanticism.
Yeah.
There's a fashion-led trend that the music was a part of, and then the kind of fashion died and the music kind of died with it a little bit. But that never really happened with Acid House. You know, electronic music came on and still going today, obviously. It was kind of the electronic version of rock and roll. It just keeps getting repackaged for the next generation coming through all the time. So
yeah, you're so right.
Yeah, to be there at the very beginning of this revolution was very, very lucky, very, very privileged.
So I mean, in your role as at Mixmag, where was it down to you? Were you actually having to go out and experience these raves and parties and be a DJ still as well, and like absorb yourself in all of that scene and like do that with your team? You know, what was that kind of era like as you was kind of almost a, you know, not only an editor of an industry magazine but a you know, a punter on the dance floor basically, you know, and experiencing that, you know, what was that vibe like during in the UK during that time and that birth of that?
Well, I stopped DJing when I went down to Mixmag, when I went down to DMC. I mean, my DJing sort of, you know, circuit was all very local around Leeds. Mm-hmm. I didn't take all my mobile equipment down with me and try to start finding gigs down there or anything. You know, I was just wanting to be absorbed in everything that was going on at DMC. There was so much going on there and it was so exciting that I was out being the punter, like you say, on the dance floor. I was going to all these raves. I used to go to the Hacienda in Manchester every weekend, used to drive back up from London every weekend and go back to Leeds, sometimes go to the warehouse in Leeds. But yeah, all these illegal raves that were happening around the M25 and all over the country that were starting to spring up through 1988, really. The summer of 88 was very transformative. Once, you know, the whole story that I'm sure has been told a million times of Paul Oakenfold, Nicky Holloway and Pete Tong and coming back from Ibiza at the end of 87 and then bringing that back in the sort of winter of 88. It all exploded. And I was there trying to report on all that and go and take in all these DJs doing all this new thing, going to Spectrum and Land of Oz and Hume and all these things and the Hacienda and all. So I was just trying to take it all in, trying to report on what was going on, trying to be the voice of the scene, really. That was the idea, to be the voice of this new movement that was going on, and the whole DJ as star, as focal point, DJ culture, remix culture, all this, you know, was very much a part of the ethos of what DMC was built upon. So it was a natural progression to take that to the masses, really, you know, to be the Bible, as we you mentioned before, you know, the dance music Bible, really, was a club Bible, as it really became through the 90s.
Absolutely. And, you know, you obviously had a stint there. And then the next, what did you do kind of next? I know, you know, you teamed up with Steve Anderson and Brothers in Rhythm, and, you know, you're DJing Shelly's around that era as well. I mean, how did they happen at the same time? What happened next after Mixmag?
Yeah, it all kind of was happening simultaneously, really. I moved down October 87. Sort of by May 88, that's when the previous editor left, and I'd started to work at the magazine, looking after the magazine, really being editor. I was kind of standing editor for a few months, and then eventually they just said, well, you carry on, you're doing a good job. So and Steve Anderson, I think, joined late 88, I think. So he came in to start working in the studios. I was already working at the magazine. And so we were the two young kids in the company, really, that had just joined and both living and breathing the new revolution that was going on. Although Steve didn't really go clubbing so much, but he was very, very studio orientated and musically orientated. So was really and came from a DJ background. So he was really, really into all everything that was happening. So he came up. He was coming. You know, DMC was split into all the offices. Mixmag offices were upstairs and all the studios were downstairs. He would come upstairs and do some writing for the magazine, and I would go downstairs and hang out in the studios on an evening. And then we ended up doing a remix of Style Council's Promised Land, I think, was the first thing we ever did together for DMC only. One of the DMC albums that we were talking about, we did a lot of remixes exclusively for them. We were Brothers in Rhythm, and we made Peace and Harmony off the back of the Style Council remix, and then Such a Good Feeling, which went on to become a pop hit, you know. And all of a sudden, Brothers in Rhythm started to explode. And this was 1990-91. Also at the same time, the guy who was my photographer, Gary McLarnon, who was one sort of my head main photographer at Mixmag, who I used to go to a lot of the raves, a lot of the clubs with. I used to do the writing report. I used to take all the photos. He started a club in Stoke called Shelley's. Because Hacienda closed down for a little while. They were having some problems with some gangs in Manchester around that time. The Hacienda got closed. So everybody was looking for a new place to go. He said, oh, I've got this club in Stoke. Well, let's get Sasha to come and play there. Sasha only wanted to do 3 weeks out of every four because he was getting offered some gigs in other parts of the country on a Friday night as well that he wanted to go do too. So Gary said to me, do you want to do the other week, the fourth week, and maybe do some warm-ups on the other nights when Sasha's playing? So that's how I got back into DJing, really. And how I got onto 12 Technics turntables, and all of a sudden I was actually playing in a club to a very, very hungry dance floor. Of course, I had access to all the music from being at Mixmag. I was getting all the music first, because my company were sending me white labels and promos. So that was great. And at DMC, they had Technics turntables as well. So I had a chance to actually learn how to properly mix and be surrounded by a lot of people who were very good at mixing as well at the DMC offices. Chad Jackson was the world mixing champion when I went down there. I actually shared a house with him when I moved down. So I was getting, I was in good hands then. If you're talking about mentors a bit further down the line, once I got to DMC, then yes, there was a lot of people that I learned a lot from. So yeah, so this was all 1989, 1990, 91. I was working at Mixmag. I was started the Brothers in Rhythm. I started DJing in nightclubs again, and it all kind of all aspects of what I was doing was taking off.
Wow!
So it got to the point where I couldn't actually manage all of them. And after about 3 years of being editor of Mixmag, I realized that I preferred the actual DJing side of it and the production side of it, and the writing, was something, and running a magazine was something that people who were better qualified, who had better experience and qualifications to do it, probably was a good time for them to take over and take Mixmag onto the next level, which Dom Phillips and David Davis were the two people that myself and Nick Gordon Brown, who was my assistant editor, we got Dom and David to come and take over from us, and Nick and I went on to start Stress Records. So we kind of swapped running the magazine for starting a record label. So then it was DJing, production, and running a record label, which kind of has been my three different strings to my bow ever since, really.
Yeah.
30 years.
That's nuts. And yeah, like you say, it's all going on at that time. I mean, I do want to dive in a little bit into Shelley's, if I may, because, you know, we've spoken to loads of DJs on this podcast, and, you know, the name that always comes up is the Hacienda or whatever, you know, and that's the one that kind of everyone's super familiar with. And sometimes you mention Shelley's and it's, you know, it's not necessarily talked about as much, but it's obviously as important as Hacienda. And like you said, when that club closed for a bit, everyone needed somewhere else to go. And it's almost that equidistance between Manchester and Birmingham that kind of gave it a bit of a different vibe and a different crowd. Can you just take us through like what a Shelley's type of night was and what kind of music was being played there? And, you know, that cult feeling around, you know, yourself being there and Sasha being there as well. What was it all like?
It's very difficult to explain how exciting it was. To, you know, everybody was living for that Friday night, you know, they all week waiting for that, just to get into that club. And it really was, as soon as those doors opened, people ran into the club and ran straight on the dance floor. They didn't go and like mill around the bar and wait for people to arrive. And, you know, about an hour and a half later, a few people might go on, and people ran onto the dance floor from the minute. And it was full within half an hour, because people had been queuing for an hour and a half before the doors opened, to literally get in and run straight in, because it only ran from 10 till 2 a.m. was the finishing time back then, which was why part of the reason why all these raves were going on, because people wanted to be out all night, and nightclubs were licensed until 2 o'clock. So it was very intense. I mean, you know, ecstasy was playing a big part in that whole revolution of the whole loved up feel. The social landscape of the UK changed dramatically through these years. You know, I'm from Leeds, so if we went to Manchester pre acid house in 1985 and went to a nightclub, this was football hooliganism kind of territory. You know, it was tribal, it was territory driven. You know, if I open my mouth with a Yorkshire accent in another city, not Manchester, any other city in the UK, there'd be people, you know, out on a Friday or Saturday night just looking for a fight. That's what they did, you know. And it was, so when ecstasy arrived and dance music arrived in 88, that was just wiped out over one summer. And all of a sudden, people were traveling all over the country and being welcomed. Everybody loved each other. And that, of course, that was a lot driven by the drug, of course. But that went on, you know, and really changed how people were receptive to people's sexuality and race. And it really broke down so many barriers. And the music was euphoric, you know, so people were going out to really have an amazing time. Shelley's particularly was driven by Italian piano house. Mm-hmm. So there was lots of amazing euphoric drops, and there's no phones, there's no distractions. It was ecstasy's drug was all about being, it's a communal drug. It's about people all being together and celebrating life and having a great time and feeling great and loving each other. And so that boiled into one intense little period every Friday night and Saturday night and any other night of the week if anybody could get it. was super, super life-changing. As I say, the whole social fabric landscape of the UK changed over one summer, and by the end of the 80s, I mean, everybody was the way people had more respect for each other and were more accepting and open and tolerant and everything was it's hard to kind of say how transformative it was those times. And Shelley's was right, you know, right there. And, you know, people were out to have the best time of their lives. And that's why everybody looks back on it. So people talk about Shelley's or Hacienda, they talk about those times because it was the most amazing of times, you know. Yeah. And it was new, it was fresh. It was, you know, like something that you never experienced before. I think that's key as well. Now people take for granted everybody going together and, you know, all jumping up and down to a breakdown on a festival or whatever. That didn't really happen pre this time was when it all changed.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound. And you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Yeah, you're completely right. And, you know, you mentioned how the music there was fueled by, you know, a real kind of communal, happy, piano-driven kind of sound. And obviously you were behind some of that with Brothers in Rhythm and Such a Good Feeling and those kind of records as well. When you were making those, were you making those with that kind of dance floor in mind? Like, I want to make a track I can play in a certain environment? Or was it just a case of, this is what's prevalent right now and I feel like I should jump on it?
No, they're both those records. Most of the records I made early with Steve as Brothers in Rhythm were all made for specific dance floors. Peace and Harmony was made for the Hacienda dance floor. Mm-hmm. Such a Good Feeling was made for the Shelley's dance floor. The Mighty Ming was made for the Renaissance Venue 44 dance floor. They were all specifically, you know, make targeted to one particular nightclub back then. Yeah,
cool. I mean, yeah, and you mentioned Renaissance there. I want to kind of talk about that. I mean, you've got a really long association with that brand. I mean, it's a huge brand, a real mark of quality in the scene, and it kind of marked a bit of difference in terms of a different almost approach. I don't want to say high end or glamorous because that makes it sound like it's exclusive and not as inclusive, but it had a different level of kind of feeling and production and the artwork and all of those things together. I mean, can you give us some background on how you got involved with Renaissance?
Well, Jeff, who owns Renaissance, was used to go to Shelley's, so I used to know him from being on the dance floor at Shelley's. And then when Shelley's kind of sort of tailed off a little bit towards the end of 91, you know, like anything, I suppose, you know, it became, everybody knew it, got to know about it, and then you got all sorts of elements of people that weren't necessarily there really for the right reasons, for the music, or, you know, Sasha, you know, got a bit disillusioned with it, and me quite soon afterwards. And so, yeah, Jeff wanted to start a new place that went back to where, you know, people who were really into it from the beginning, who were really there for the music, could just a new home for that, really. And so it was a little bit more exclusive. You know, you had to make a bit of an effort to get a little bit more dressed up. There was certainly production values. That's one thing that Renaissance really brought to the table and still do to this day. You know, the the production wasn't some sort of sweaty rave pit anymore. It was a bit more glamorous. People wanted to get dressed up a little bit. Yeah, it was just the next logical progression, really. It was taking, being a bit more artistic with it, taking it to the next level. And of course, now some of the production that you get in some of the festivals, but that was the start of it. That was taking it out of the very basic in being in a fields and basic nightclubs and trying to take it to a next level, really.
Yeah. And that really became the home of what became known as kind of progressive house and that kind of sound. And you mentioned Venue 44, and obviously Renaissance existed in numerous places kind of across the country over different eras. For me, I went to uni in Nottingham, and I was there from 98 to 2002. So for me, when Renaissance opened in Media in 99, that was just completely mind-blowing. And, you know, I was there every weekend. I used to love that place. I mean, for you, having played at those different eras and different places in different cities, what for you defines the peak Renaissance? What is the one that is like, that is the ultimate Renaissance era?
Well, for me, Venue 44, I think when it first started, was amazing in Mansfield. Mm-hmm. It really was. Cherish some of those nights. But yeah, I mean, it did continue right through to, like you say, Media was amazing. The Cross around sort of the end of the 90s, early 2000s, when Renaissance were at the Cross regularly in London, and then Media in Nottingham, and all those stately home parties that they did as well around that time was amazing times as well. And I did some crazy tours with them as well around the world, Australia and Asia and stuff around then as well. So that was definitely a memorable, amazing period that I look back on with real fondness as well.
They're kind of seen as the brand that introduced the Mix album, obviously with the Mix Collection Volume 1, Sasha and Digweed and whatever. And you've done, I think, is it 10 Renaissance Mix albums over the years?
Done quite a few.
Yeah. I mean, that as a format really was kind of back before those things came out. It was just a compilation album, you know, like now that's what I call music number 24 or whatever would be the thing that people would buy, or like a dance music hits album. There wasn't necessarily anything available where you could listen to what a DJ would be doing in a club. I mean,
not commercially available, no, but I mean there was, but it was all leg tapes.
Exactly. And you know, so when you were approaching those mixes or any mix album, obviously you've done four for Global Underground as well, which is another huge brand, when you're approaching those and creating those, what do you want to achieve? Is it different from creating a track or an album? You know, what are you trying to put together with those?
Well, the Mix album changed over the years. Actually pre-Renaissance, myself and Carl Cox did the very first commercially available DJ mix compilation back in 1991, I believe. Mix Mag Live. Volume 1 was the first one. And Journeys by DJs, they kind of did a series as well. Renaissance, was 93, was it? 92, 93, something like that. I think that they did the Mix Collection. Stress were records we were doing, DJ Culture. I did a mix with Sasha, a mix CD. So, yeah, I mean, they were... DJ mixes at the time were very much driven by bootleg cassettes. DJs were recording their sets all the way through that acid house period of 88, 89. And those cassettes were circulating, and that's how people got to hear them. And then obviously once DMC Mix Mag Live was one of the first ones, because DMC had a good relationship with PRS, with the PPL and all of the authorities, the record industry authorities, to be able to license tracks and make that kind of thing happen. And then of course, Renaissance came, Sasha and Digweed did Mix Collection, and then the Ministry of Sound started, and Global Underground, who were doing illegal cassettes before that. But then everybody realized that this could be done as a, you know, you could actually license these tracks properly and put them out, and people would lap them up and they would sell in their thousands, which they did. So when you were approaching them, it kind of, those early ones were very much just a live mix, really. Just trying to get it out properly available in the shops, so the artists would get paid, and you know, everybody, rather than it just be a dodgy out the back of a car boot, a load of bootlegs. So that was the initial thing. But then obviously, as technology developed, you realized that you could do a lot more than, you know, mixing wasn't just a turntable, two turntables and a mixer. You could go into a computer and you could start layering lots of different things over the top, and you could do edits and change things around. And so you could, rather than it being like one record layered into the next one, you could start having like layer upon layer, and it could become like this really quite creative audio collage, a real piece of art. The idea of mixing became something way, way, way more than just, you know, going from one record to the next. And that's where, you know, those Global Underground albums and the later Renaissance albums, started to take mixed compilations onto another level. It's like a jigsaw puzzle, really. You know, you find all these various pieces, and you find a way to kind of put them all together to make this whole, which is much greater than the sum of its parts. And that's a labor of love that can, you know, spend weeks and weeks on some of these things, not just rock up and set the turntables up and set record and that was it. That's, you know, if you want to see, I always said, if you want to go see a DJ live, or if you want to go see a band live, go see them live, you know, go see them do that. But then you wouldn't expect a band to only put out a live set as their album. They'll go in the studio and they'll create this amazing, you know, get creative and create this thing that they can do because they're in a studio. And it's the same for DJs, really. You can do so much more, be so much more creative, and then go out and play live as well. It's two separate things. That's where the compilations became what they turned into.
I mean, I always did enjoy like seeing just the track list on them and just being educated in a way that, you know, it wasn't just four to the floor, like, you know, 125 BPM or whatever. It was, you know, some decent left field choices that were down tempo. You know, there's a track actually that you've chosen for one of your five tracks. I won't say which one it is now, but I discovered from one of your mix collections, and it's this beautiful piece of music. And it's just like, you know, that sense of discovery as well, where it's, you know, you go see a DJ play and it's, you know what you're going to get, like a live experience, like you say, but getting a mix album, you feel like they've put, you know, really brought a lot more to bear on it in terms of taste.
It allows you to be a little bit more creative than you would, you know, than you're able to do in a live environment. Obviously, again, as technology's changed, now you can do a lot of these things live as well. You can really remix and layer and loop and do stuff live. Back then you couldn't really do that, you know. This is pre-digital when we're talking, you know. I mean, there were CD players, but they were very, very basic. You couldn't loop things up really back then. and do layers upon layers. I mean, you know, again, we talked, it was some of those early mix compilations that I did, I was still mixing them on turntables, but I was mixing them in segments and then editing them together and then putting them and then going in the studio and doing overdubs over the top of them. So again, it was, as technology's developed, you know, obviously things have, you've been allowed to do more and more and more.
Yeah, totally. And you know, you're talking about technology and what you can do in that live environment. You've obviously seen it go from, and we've talked about belt drive turntables to Technics to CDJs to digital to, you know, you don't necessarily even need to have any kind of, you could just rock up with a laptop and a, you know, a mixer and off you go. Where did you stand on that crossover point where it went from vinyl to digital? And you know, obviously there are massive benefits there in terms of you not having to lug like heavy record cases around and whatever, and just, you know, but then, you know, people were technically sometimes a bit snooty about it. How did that exist and grow with you, that digital kind of crossover during that time?
CDJ 1000 was when it was all flipped on its head, when Pioneer brought out the CDJ 1000. Yeah, because that really, you know, you could it was the simulation with the platter there, as you know, you could scratch a CD backwards and forwards and spin it back, and that was when everything changed, really. Prior to that, you know, you could make, there were, you know, people, there was obviously CDJs before that, and Denon's, and you know, CDJ 500, I think that was before that, wasn't it? But they weren't, it wasn't the same as vinyl. You couldn't do the same things. So once they came up with a machine that really simulated vinyl, then it became something different. And then, of course, you know, with that's when you said you didn't have to suddenly carry all the vinyl around, which was really heavy and really cumbersome, and you could also record, you know, you could be making music and people could, you could get something on a CD like that. Mm-hmm. From you could be in the studio and burn a CD and take it out and play with you that night. Couldn't do that with vinyl. You know, vinyl took weeks to be able to get it prepped up. So so to be able to just make something and then go play it that night. You know, that whole convenience thing. And then as digital obviously progressed, you know, to be able to do your own edits and then turn up with a USB with, like, you know, a month's worth of music on a chewing gum stick, you know, rather than carrying 100 record boxes equivalent or something. There's pros and cons, of course there is, you know. What also happened with the digital era is it really devalued music, you know. Mm-hmm. There's no value whatsoever in an MP3, really, you know. You can't I can't sell on an MP3 to somebody. Yeah. I bought it, you know? Yeah. But vinyl actually still holds, literally doesn't, you know, have a value. I can sell it on to somebody. It retains something. So it's physical. So there's ups and downs, of course, and you know, there's back to the idea of having a collection, physical collection of something is much more appealing to me. Well, my vinyls are over there. The ability over lockdown to be able to go through it all and do a big sort out of my vinyl, and I really fallen back in love with it and started buying it again as well. Not necessarily to play out, but just I don't really. There's no, you know, folders of MP3s from 2006 that I've got in the cloud. It's not exciting to go and go trailing through a folder of MP3s on my computer. Yeah. Whereas, you know, going through pulling records out, and that emotional attachment there is to a piece of vinyl and the memory that it really holds much more so than all MP3s that all look the same, that are all just, you know, just. That's unfortunate, the downside of it. But there was many upsides as well.
Yeah.
The ability to send something across the world like that and put it on your stick and play it that night and do your own edit of it, make your own mm-hmm. version of it there and then in your hotel room. And yeah, I mean, the creative possibilities are endless.
Yeah, like you say, and there's no joy or there's no excitement going through a folder of MP3s or whatever. And like, I struggle so much to remember the names of things, but I know what color the sleeve was or what the label looked like, or, you know, as soon as you pull that out and you see it, you can hear it. I can hear it in my head. I see it written down on a screen. It takes me ages to remember what's what.
That is, yeah, as I say, pros and cons, but I'm really back in love with vinyl again at the moment. I'm collecting.
Yeah.
My boyhood passion of collecting records has been rekindled.
I think a lot of DJs, I've seen a few collections, including some of yours as well, go up for sale. And I think because lockdown has just afforded people with huge collections just to go through them and rediscover that love. And sometimes maybe people are like, oh, well, why have I got two of these? Or this one's never been played or whatever. I mean, was that a wrench to sell some of that vinyl, or was it a case of it felt good to relieve yourself of this?
Yeah, it was cathartic. I'd already got rid of thousands a few years ago, about 10 years ago when we moved house. I had about 10,000 and they were all in boxes in the garage, and I'd been for ages. I hadn't really even got them out. And so, yeah, it afforded me the time, you know, to go through them all. And yeah, I had several copies of certain things. You know, what am I doing with five copies of things? Boxes sometimes of some of my own stuff. What am I keeping a box of 25 of a record from, you know, from 20 years ago? So, yeah, so it was really cathartic to go through it all. And lots of stuff that I, you know, records that maybe meant something back then but didn't really mean anything anymore, didn't stand the test of time, falling out of love with. A lot of acetates, which I didn't really need anymore, but to some people they're real collector's items, mm-hmm. real genuine collectors, because they are properly one-offs. And so it was a case of going through, and I wanted to get my 10,000 I had about, and I've probably got down to about six now, probably, you know, offloaded about 4,000 of the stuff that I didn't need anymore, and I needed a bit more space to start filling up. So one man's trash is another man's treasure kind of thing, and you find a new home for it. It was a project that was something that kept me going through a really enjoyable cathartic process. Kept me going through lockdown.
No way. And I mean, is there a temptation that you've rediscovered some stuff that might be, you know, 10, 15 years old that you're like, actually, I'm going to start playing this out again. I really enjoy this. And playing off vinyl as well again. Is that going to be a thing?
Both of those things. I have taken digital copies of quite a few things. So I've got them now. Playing vinyl, I'm not going to go out and take vinyl around the world anymore. But I probably will. I mean, I have been buying a lot of new stuff again. I probably will do maybe a vinyl stream at the end of the year, maybe like a year end best of this year stuff on vinyl. There's been lots of ideas and things being stimulated from going through old records and finding old samples and oh yeah, this sounds amazing still, and you know, maybe I should make something along these lines, take an inspiration from. I mean, it's a wall of inspiration now, this for me, that everything on the shelf means something, takes me back to a particular era, you know, stimulates, you know, some creativity, inspiration. Yes. And not only that, it's an archive, you know. I've got books on there as well, and I'm going to sort some CDs out over there and DVDs and everything. It's going to be a wall of you know, everything that I've loved over my you know, collecting art and music and culture and stuff. That is one of the best things that came out of lockdown for me, for sure.
Yeah, it's that ongoing project, I think, that any DJ or any music lover has, that, you know, that add, tweak, refine, you know, get rid of, and just keep building, shaping. Exactly. And I mean, in terms of, you've mentioned as well about record labels and what you've been doing amongst there. Obviously, you've mentioned Stress, there's Audio Therapy, and there's your new project, latest project, Celador. I mean, you know, obviously across all three of those, you've had some brilliant releases, iconic tracks, you've worked with legends. You know, what are you trying to achieve when you're running a label, and what are you on the lookout for in terms of artists and sound, and you know, what you're just trying to create in that pocket that you own?
Well, just music that excites us, really, whatever that might be. Three very different eras again there, you know, between of the three different labels. But currently, we sell Adore, which is the label I run with Steve Parry, and we're 9 years into that, up to our 150th release already. 150 releases. That's wow. I mean, you're always as a DJ, you're always on the hunt for new music. Get sent a lot of demos. Obviously, I have a lot of relationships with a lot of producers and people I've known for years that's constantly sending us stuff. And as a label owner, you want to, you know, present, you know, if somebody gives you a piece of music to release, then you want to present that in the best possible way you can, really. So, and there's so much to do now in terms of, you know, it was a bit simpler back in the day, I think, when it was vinyl, but with so many different platforms and so many different ways to market things and so many social media channels and there's so many boxes to tick now. Every release is a real mission, a real campaign to try and obviously there's so much music out there to try and get heard, try and get heard is another challenge every time you put something out. So we're just looking for music that I mean, the real basic criteria for getting something on Celador is something that me and Steve both love. Both of us have to love it. One can't love it and the other one's not quite so sure. We both have to really love it so we can really put our full force behind it, and then try and present it and try to do the best job to get that out there to do the best by the artist. And at the same time for the label to, you know, to keep growing the label as a home that people trust, you know, for the kind of music that we put out. Hopefully that, you know, they think, if you're a fan of what we do, you almost buy a Celador release without even having to listen to it, because you kind of trust what we do, and that's the ultimate, the holy grail, I suppose, that you get enough of a community to love what you do, and obviously you can take that into branding and doing gigs and merchandise and everything else that goes with running a gang, you know, a community. So it's another addictive thing. It's a process that you're always looking for the next thing, always the next release, it's a lot of work goes into running a label now. People don't realize. I mean, it's always been a lot of work going into it, but so much more so now than ever before.
And another kind of stage that's happened in the past, I'm talking about 3D, and you, it's almost like that super group, like the Traveling Wilburys of Progressive House. It's brilliant, you know. Dave Seam and Danny Howells.
Danny and Owen, I love that one. The Traveling Wilburys of Progressive House. We're going to use that as a tagline on all the flyers from now on.
There you go. You can have that. Yeah, yourself, Danny Howells, and Darren Emerson. I mean, obviously, you've probably, you know, been friends on the circuit for years and whatever. How did that come together? Was it always something you talked about doing and it just happened? And how do you guys operate as a threesome? How do you operate behind the decks? And is it a free for all?
Yeah, no, it was just by accident. We all got booked to play the Ministry of Sound on the same night. And after a few drinks with the promoter of the time, I'd say, we should call it 3D, Dave, Danny and Darren. After a few drinks, and the next thing I knew, he'd made a flyer that said 3D on it. And then we did the gig. And then on the Monday after that, we started getting phone calls asking if people could book 3D as if it was suddenly a thing. And it was all just a happy accident, really. Of course, we had a great night together because we all known each other for years. Mm. We all come from a similar era, similar background. The got the GU albums all behind us, you know. So and it just became a thing. Suddenly we realized that actually doing a tour of South America together or America together was a fun thing to do rather than traveling on your own. We could all carry on with our individual careers, but it was like another string to our bow. And you know, three of us together is, you know, greater than the sum of our parts, really, for a festival or whatever. They can put all three of us together, and it was something new, give a bit of fresh impetus to what we were doing. And it was a challenge. I think that was the thing as well, because all three of us all have our own individual styles, really, even though we come from a similar background. So to try and knit that together in a coherent, cohesive set was something that was a bit of a challenge. And after 30 plus years of DJing, a new challenge is a good thing to have. So that's an ongoing thing. Obviously, lockdown's kind of stopped us getting together and doing so much stuff. We just usually play a couple of tracks each, and then maybe a track each as the night develops. And kind of weave our own sort of little nuances into a patchwork of traveling Wilbury's quilt.
and is there any kind of hijinks behind the decks? Is someone trying to put the other one off, or are you strictly professional 100% of the time? What's kind of happening there?
Oh, well, obviously it's important that we still retain a degree of professionalism, but we do have fun, and I think that's plain for people to see, and I think that can be infectious. I think, you know, if you go see a DJ and you see that they're actually having fun, I think that kind of transmits itself to the dance floor as well. So I think it's important to show that.
Absolutely. Okay, so yeah, to wrap this up, we'll come on to the perfect playlist. So the House Culture Perfect Playlist, it's on Spotify. It's existed since the very first episode of the podcast, and every single one of our guests has submitted five tunes based on one of the five themes that we have. And, you know, it's a huge beast. It's, you know, nearly a day long, I think now. And there's some incredible selection of tunes on there. Some really, really huge anthems, some things that you might not have heard of, and some things from left field, and especially with some of the themes that we've cover, you know, some things that aren't necessarily even dance music either. So, you know, it's a real kind of place to discover music, and you've been really good, and you've given me the choices up front. They're all fantastic choices. And if we could just go through each one individually and just get a little bit of like your experience with that track, maybe the first time you heard it or why you love it, and you know, what special place does that have for you. So we always start off with The Catalyst. So a track that first kind of got you into dance music or electronic music, and you have chosen
Herbie Hancock, Rocket. I was going to say New Order, Blue Monday, because New Order, they both came out roughly the same time. Mm-hmm. But I mean, everybody knows Blue Monday. but yeah, say similar era. Blue Monday was one of the first. When you talk about things that got me into dance music, well, there was a lot of records pre 1983, which is the year we're talking about, that were dance music, but I never really saw them as dance music. They were just pop records that were, you know, they were dance records that were in the pop charts, really, you know. So all the disco stuff and Blue Monday would have been like one of the first real electronic club records. It only came out as a 12-inch, you know. It was, and Arthur Baker produced, and it really got me into club music as well. But the same year, but as I say, that's quite obvious. So the same year, also another record that really grabbed my attention, and I really realized that it was a real record that was really different and really turned me on to lots of things, was Herbie Hancock's Rocket. It was a record from outer space. It really was. All the scratching that was going on it. It was just as I became aware of breakdancing, which I got heavily into around about that time, started breakdancing. And it really, yeah, so the whole New York culture of the time, it was a combination of those two records, actually, because obviously Arthur Baker did Blue Monday. So he was making Booker's Revenge around that time and all that New York club culture. At the same time, New York was the epicenter of breakdancing and Herbie Hancock's Rocket was something that was just like, wow, what is that? I need more of that. I need to know more about that. And to this day, it's still an amazing, amazing record. Nearly 40 years old, both of them.
That is crazy to think about that. Is it the first record to feature like scratching on it or something like that as well? And just to hearing that sound.
Yeah, there might have been a couple of rap records before that were, you know, that were had some scratching on them. But yeah, we're certainly one of the main ones that actually crossed over and became a worldwide hit.
Yeah, yeah. And so we move on to the next one, which is a Floor Filler. And you've been, this is quite interesting, actually, because a lot of people sometimes, if they're an artist or a DJ, do sometimes pick a track by themselves. So what have you chosen?
Shameless self-promotion, mate. What are we in this for? If I'm not going to shout about it, I can't rely on everybody else to shout about it.
Wise words.
And to be honest, yeah, when you say Floor Filler, well, I mean, obviously I could choose lots of different things, but I wanted to choose something current. And when I'm making records in the studio, that's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to make a record that's going to fill the floor, that's going to be one of the peak records in my sets. So I chose one of my own. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You don't like it.
it's gonna go straight in there. Yeah. It's great.
So this was one that a track that I put out earlier this year called Buzz Fuzzle, which was a record which was made through lockdown. It actually started it before lockdown, and then through various sessions I was with somebody else, a guy that worked in the studio with called Jay Gilbert. So we did a few remote sessions to kind of finish it off and put it out in January, and I'm really, really pleased with it. And it was funny because talking about floor filling, of course, it came out when there wasn't any floors to fill. So then when I started DJing again, I'd almost forgotten about it because we were on to the next lot of, you know, 6 months after I'd made it. So, and it was somebody else that came up and asked for it, I requested it, and I was like, oh god, I haven't even played that out to a dance floor. And I did play it at our recent Celadoria night. We've started at some new night label nights under the banner Celadoria, which we had our first one in London at E1, and it was one of the biggest records of the night. I was really, really pleased. So there you go, Floor Filler.
Amazing. And it works as well. That's incredible. Yeah, that's awesome. And okay, so next one is the Sunsetter, perfect track to soundtrack a sunset.
Yeah. So going back to 1989, I think, summer of 89, with the Summer of Love around about that time. The Cure, Lullaby. Is a record that I still associate with long, lazy, sunny afternoons and sunsets. It's just an amazing Balearic treasure, a real gem of a record that obviously doesn't really come from electronic music culture, but really does fit in with that Balearic kind of feel of what was going on that summer, and still sounds amazing to this day. I love that record. The Cure, Lullaby.
Yeah, there's so much going on in that. It's got a real, real mood to it. It's awesome. Okay, and this is the one that I kind of alluded to earlier. My wife, bless her, she's going to love this as well, because this is the tearjerker.
Mine too.
It's such a beautiful track. What have you chosen, and just tell me a bit more about it.
I chose Gorecchi by Lam. I mean, as you mentioned before, I actually had it on a couple of compilations back in the 90s, an amazing record, one of the best records ever made for me. I definitely have it in my top 10 of all time. And yeah, I mean, my wife will love it as well, because we had it played at our wedding. one of the best love songs ever written. It's very difficult to write a love song without being cliched, with so many hundreds of thousands of records being written about love. But they did it in a really fresh, beautiful way, and those opening chords and stuff are spine tingling and very emotional to this day. I mean, yeah, as I say, we had it played at our wedding when we were signing the register, so it always brings back some great emotions.
Yeah, it's stunning. And even like, I think when we went to the cinema years ago, my wife and I, and saw Moulin Rouge, and it's in that, and just out of nowhere Nicole Kidman starts singing it, and it was like, you know, I get the arm grab from my missus, like, wow, this is, yeah, it's such a beautiful piece of music.
Yeah, it's always hairs on the back of your neck, that one, for sure.
Yeah, I've literally just felt them just now. Cool. Okay, and so a last tune, it's the end of the night, crowd are asking for one more. What'd you play?
Yeah, I thought I'd do something current again, because we had a few oldies in amongst those ones. So one of the best records I think made this year for me was something that came out over the summer, and actually beautiful remix by Sebastian Leger of Cypherpunk's On Renaissance. Again, somebody else we mentioned a lot of On Renaissance records, featuring Koshin, Sean Evans. Amazing record called Aliens. Beautiful end of the night moment.
Perfect. And so this is the last question we always ask our guests. We are House Culture, and obviously you're part of the culture of the scene. You've been in it for 30 years. You've done it all, you know, and you're still doing it, which is fantastic. You know, a real kind of, you know, this whole conversation has been so much knowledge and passion and everything within that. When you look back on what you've achieved so far and your place within the culture of the scene, and then you look at your life alongside that, what has dance music brought to you as a whole?
Well, it's been the soundtrack to my life, obviously, and it's been my career. You know, it's been my passion and my career rolled into one, which is always something I try and tell my boys. If you can find something that you love, really love, and you can make a career out of it, then you never have to work a day in your life, really. Not quite that, quite like that in reality. There's a lot of work goes into it, but yeah, I mean, it's, yeah, to do something that you really enjoy makes it a lot easier to get up every morning, and it's been everything, really, from word go. Obviously my family and alongside that is but that whole thing together has been everything. I mean, my passion, my career, my love from a very early age, something that I can see myself doing until the day I drop. I don't see any reason to hang my headphones up, and I've got no intention of doing so. Music is the healing force, isn't it? It's the language that we all speak, no matter where we come from, and can bring everybody together and do so much. We'll always be one of the main things in my life, for sure.
Perfect. That's a great final thought to end on. That's brilliant. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me. Talk soon. See ya.
House Culture.
That was brilliant, wasn't it? Not only do I feel like I've learned all about Dave's career, but I've also been given a thorough education on the birth of house music in the UK, told by a genuine expert. I want to say a huge thanks to Dave for sitting down with us for that chat. Much appreciated. You also heard Dave choose some incredible tracks for our House Culture Perfect playlist, which you can find over on Spotify. Just search that up, you'll be able to listen to the submissions from all of our previous podcast guests. Just stick it on shuffle, turn it up loud, you will not be disappointed. Then once you vibe into that stellar selection, please don't forget to do all of that good stuff for us. I'm talking loving, liking, tweeting, sharing, telling your friends or leaving us a review. We love to hear your feedback, and if you have some nice things to say, we'll make sure you give you a shout out on a future episode. And then if you don't follow us already, come and join our party over on our Instagram feed at HouseCultureNet or by following the hashtag TrueHouseCulture. We're all about the positivity and the fun stuff that this musical movement can bring, so don't be a stranger. Come on over and say hi. And finally, if you want to get in touch with me, Matt Rouse, you can do that directly on Instagram at DJ Matt Rouse. Thanks for listening. Rave safe and see you next time.
House Culture.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.